And good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. Thanks for tuning in today. There are at least 10,000 lakes in Minnesota. Is there one you have a special relationship with? This is Water Month at Minnesota Public Radio, which means we're taking a close look at one of our state's most abundant natural resources and talking about ways to keep water clean. This hour, we're talking about lakes. Why do they hold such a special place in our lives? We want you to call in and tell us which one is your favorite and why. We're also going to talk about some of the problems facing our lakes, from pollution to invasive species and encroaching development. So it's a good time to get in a question about lakes. I'm joined by two guests this hour. Adam Heathcote is a research scientist at the St. Croix Watershed Research Station, which is run by the Science Museum of Minnesota. And Jeff Forrester is an executive director of Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates. Call us and tell us about your favorite lake. The number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Adam Heathcote, Jeff Forrester, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
Let's start with the big picture. Why does Minnesota have so many lakes? And Adam, how about you?
Sure. The main reason we have so many lakes is because almost the entire state was covered by the last glaciation, which was 10 to 13,000 years ago, depending on what part of the state you're in. And when that glacier retreated, it left all kinds of ice blocks scattered all across the state. And those ice blocks basically formed depressions when they melted, which then naturally filled in with water as our stream drainage networks were formed.
So we all learned that in school, that the glaciers gouged out the,
yep,
the land.
In Minnesota, so if you, the glacier just went kind of just into the northwest corner of Iowa, and that was as far as it went, but it covered the entire state of Minnesota. So we have, you know, a few lakes in northwestern Iowa, no natural lakes anywhere else in the state.
Jeff, I don't know if you can answer this, but does Minnesota have more lakes than any other state?
Well, I've heard that we have more shoreline than California, Florida, and Hawaii combined.
Wow.
Yeah, lots of islands, lots of meandering shorelines. I don't know if we have more lakes than any other state, but I suspect so. Maybe Michigan.
Adam,
do you have the figures
on that?
I actually looked this up in preparation for this today. So the only state that has more area in terms of lakes is Alaska, and sometimes we don't count that because they're not in the lower 48.
Okay.
And in terms of the proportion of the land area that is covered by lakes, the only one with more is Maine, although we have more total lakes than Maine. So in the lower 48, we definitely have the most lakes.
So is 10,000 lakes about right?
Well, I've heard anything from 11,000, 13,000 to 100,000, depending on the size of where the cutoff is. So I think the original cutoff was something like 100 hectares was, you know, the smallest they'd count. And as we get better at counting lakes, that number keeps going up and up and up.
Huh.
Because there are a lot of lakes, a lot of small lakes in places like the Boundary Waters that have never been counted before.
Well, I think if you get to 100,000, you must be counting puddles.
Well, it depends on what you call a puddle. I worked in Quebec before I came to Minnesota, and they have 1.6 million lakes there, so, and they've done quite an extensive survey. So I would guess that that number is going to go up as we get better at counting them.
Well, how do we count the lakes?
Well, originally we counted them as anyone might expect. We went to them and, you know, put them into an atlas and kept track of them. The latest technology we use is satellite technology, and basically the constraint on that is the resolution of the satellites, and so as that gets better and better, we're able to count smaller and smaller lakes.
Huh. Well, is it once a lake, always a lake, or could something be a lake during the rainy part of the year and maybe dry up later? Do you still count it as a lake?
So that would be a wetland. So any ephemeral body of water where it's not open water year-round, we would, by definition, not call lakes. So that might be a hard cutoff there.
Okay.
But is it a lake or a pond, I guess, is the...
Well, that's another question.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a lake and a pond?
I would say it's the observer's opinion on what's...
Right. Size.
If your house happens to be on a pond, you might call it a lake.
Right.
Okay. Fair enough. Talking about lakes today, because it's part of Water Month here at Minnesota Public Radio, Adam Heathcote is here. He's a research scientist at the St. Croix Watershed Research Station. And Jeff Forrester is here. He's executive director of Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates. And Jeff, let me ask you a question. What is the biggest threat to Minnesota's lakes? We hear about all kinds of things that are, threatening the water.
Well, I think there's, I tend to think of it as five major threats. The first one is the water's getting warmer, and the ice in and ice out dates are changing despite what it's doing outside today. We're looking at changes in hydrology, so more water or less water, and changes in the patterns of how the water moves across our landscape. Increased runoff, nitrogen and phosphorus runoff and loading in our lakes. Mm-hmm. The size and abundance of our fish species are changing, and then aquatic invasive species. And then also shoreline development, I think, is part of that riparian habitat piece, you know, keeping healthy shorelines. That's where a lot of the interchange between the land and the lake is. A lot of stuff happens on the shoreline.
Well, why would warmer water be a problem? Why is that a problem in and of itself?
Well, the ice in and ice out dates can change the way fish spawn, or the success of the fish spawning. It can change the chemistry of the lake, so dissolved oxygen levels can change. Adam and I were talking about the loss of ciscos in the lakes as they get warmer. A lot of species are not tolerant of warmer water. Can change plant communities and where they can grow and thrive. And then, see, the problem is then you add in something like zebra mussels, which make the water clearer, and now you've got plants able to get sunlight in places where they couldn't before. So you get, you know, Eurasian water milfoil blooms or other things, and then changes in algae blooms, which Adam was talking about before we came on.
Yeah, so, I mean, Jeff did a great job describing the problems and also what's going on with temperature. And like you said, one of the biggest changes, besides the loss of some of those cold water species like cisco, is the expansion of the growing season. And so if you have an earlier ice out or later ice on or a combination of both, you're going to have a longer growing season. You're going to grow more algae in a given year, which is going to deplete more oxygen over the winter, which can lead to fish kills and things like that.
Interesting. Well, there's something I hadn't thought of. We're talking about lakes today. We want to find out, number one, what's your favorite lake? Number two, we want to take your questions about lakes. For Adam Heathcote and Jeff Forrester, give us a call. 651-227-6000 is the number. 651-227-6000. And let's take a call. Tony is on the line from Rosemont. Tony, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My favorite lake is Lake Bilsby. It's in Cannon Falls. And it's a previous river that they dammed off to make it a lake. And my question was, why is there's like green stuff in the water that like kind of moves along? And I was just wondering like what that was exactly.
Floating green stuff in Lake Bilsby.
So is it green stuff that you can actually see, like a particle, or is the water green? Or okay, so
yeah, there's particles. There's like a bunch of particles all across the lake.
Does it look like little leafed plants, kind of like duckweed, maybe?
It could be. I was thinking maybe it's like algae, but I couldn't be sure.
Yeah, so we were actually just on Lake Bilsby. It's a beautiful area, the Cannon River watershed. We were collecting some sediment samples and, you know, through the ice. My guess is, I'm guessing these are things that you see in the spring and summer and probably early fall. My guess is that it's probably algal blooms, and I'm guessing it's moving through the system, like you said, because, like you said, Lake Bilsby is a reservoir, so it's a dammed lake. It used to be just a river valley, and so it has a fairly strong current, and so, you know, moving across the lake. And so all those algae, most algae, phytoplankton by definition, move with the water, and so they're going to move with the currents of the lake, and so you'll see them moving from the inlet to the outlet and growing along the way.
Tony, before you go, if we still have you, tell us why Lake Bilsby is your favorite lake.
Just the fact that it's not even busy at all, and there's plenty of space to go tubing, and there's a lot of good fishing there.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Jeff Forrester, as people talk about their favorite lakes, what do you think makes a good lake or a lake you want to be on?
Well, clean, I think, and I like to fish, so the fishing is important. And then, you know, different lakes have different cultures on them, too. Like, if you look around the landscape of Minnesota, particularly in the lake districts, most of our communities are on lakes. And, you know, they're very different. Like, so Lake Vermilion, which is where we have a place, where my family's from, is much different than Lake Minnetonka. Just in kind of the culture or the way people use it, I don't know. I mean, I think in my job, I end up thinking about lakes often as communities. So, you know, the culture and the community that surrounds them helps define the recreational opportunities on the lakes, things like that, mm-hmm. you know. So
it's more than just the physical part of the lake itself. It's the people.
Right. Well, the people are the big piece of it, right? We dominate the landscape and make a lot of decisions that dictate how things turn out on our lakes. So mm-hmm. I don't discount the people.
Adam Heathcote, what's your favorite lake? Do you have one?
If I had to go with my favorite for personal reasons, I'd probably go with Gull Lake up near Brainerd. My family has been having a reunion every other year there since I was, I think, 6 years old. So I've got a lot of personal memories of spending, you know, a week in the summer there fishing and hanging out on the beach there. So that's the one I'd go with.
What do you think makes a good lake?
I mean, I would agree with Jeff. I mean, a lot of the things that make, you know, that people value with lakes is, you know, where they are, you know, who lives there, what personal connection do they have to them? If I'm objectively thinking about a lake, when you do, you know, social surveys, the number one thing people care about in terms of lakes is how clear the water is. And, you know, it goes up beyond that, then it goes to fisheries and things like that. But I think clear water is probably the number one value added piece of a lake. If you have a lake that's very clear, people are naturally going to want to be there and recreate there.
What makes water clear and what makes it dirty or not clear?
Well, it depends. And so, you know, when I think about clear water, I think not necessarily uncolored water. So a lot of the very, very clean, pristine lakes in northern Minnesota are brown, mm-hmm. but they're naturally brown. They're stained by organic acids, things like tannins that wash out from the watershed. And so there's nothing wrong with that. That's a perfectly good lake. It's actually what we call dissolved organic carbon. But then when you think of really turbid systems, so that's when lakes that have lots of sediment and produce lots of algae, those are the lakes that I would think of as having some problems that need to be dealt with.
And is it a problem for the lake, Jeff, or is it just our perception of the lake if it's cloudy water or turbid, I guess is the word you used?
Well, so we're on Lake Vermilion, and that's a root beer-colored lake, and it's beautiful. You know, I love it. And it's clean and it doesn't smell. But there was a study done, I think, at Morehead State University back 2004, 2005, where they looked at the clarity of water. What was the Secchi disk reading of the lake? And it had an impact on property values. And I just imagined how this played out. You know, people look at the cabin or they look at the house and it's beautiful and the yard looks nice and they walk down to the end of the dock and they look off. And if they can see the bottom, they think it's, you know, great. But, you know, with things like zebra mussels, which make water clearer, but it strips out the phytoplankton and zooplankton in the water. So it's clear, but it's not necessarily clean or healthy. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, So our initial perceptions of the clarity of water might not necessarily tell the full story.
Talking about lakes this hour with Jeff Forrester and Adam Heathcote, let's take another caller. Asta from Bald Eagle Lake.
Hello. Thank you for pronouncing my name right. You actually answered my first question, so thank you. It was about why the weeds are growing so pervasively. But my other question, as a follow-up, is we're in, like, this natural trend right now where everything has to be done without pesticides and as organically as possible. And as someone who lives on a lake where the weeds are growing immensely and killing fish, and you can actually see them at the top of the lake and motors get stuck, I was curious, do we have a plan in the state of Minnesota to try to address this weed problem? Because it's not just unsightly, it's actually ruining the ecology of some of the lakes that I've been on. And I was curious if maybe we do need to do something pesticide related, or if maybe there is some sort of way to deal with the weeds.
Okay. And I'm just going to mark you down as Bald Eagle as your favorite lake. Is that all right?
Well, I'm from White Bear Lake, and I didn't want to say White Bear Lake. I'm actually living on Bald Eagle.
Okay. Well, you can choose a different lake.
No, I love Bald Eagle. I love Bald Eagle passionately because I think Forrester's last name was Forrester, was right. It's all about community, and I just come from a very wholesome and amazing community, and it's the people, and we genuinely care about our water, and we genuinely care about getting together.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks for the call. Let's see if we can get to the bottom of your question here.
Well, I guess I'm going to assume that you're talking about invasive weeds, and I think Bald Eagle has Eurasian water milfoil. And we're working on a pilot now with Ramsey County and some of the people in that watershed on using weevils and raising them and imprinting them on Eurasian water milfoil and then releasing them back into the lake. And they'll feed on the Eurasian water milfoil to the exclusion of other plants. And it won't get rid of the milfoil, but it can keep it way down so it's not invasive. But for other native plants, I don't know, Adam, what do you think?
Yeah, good question. And I'm also from White Bear Lake and familiar with Bald Eagle Lake, so good to hear from someone from the area. Yeah, weeds are always a tricky thing because they do annoy people. They get stuck in motors, like the caller mentioned. But a lot of times the alternative to weeds is harmful algae because weeds and algae are in this kind of battle for dominance in lakes.
Right.
And the root problem is actually nutrients. And so if a lake has too much nutrients, it's going to grow either too many weeds or too much algae. And a lot of times when we're looking at management for lakes, and say it's a lake that has these harmful toxic algae blooms, the only way to get rid of those, at least temporarily or at least to initially, is to help the weeds, or we call them aquatic plants or macrophytes, to be a little nicer to them, help them take over the system at least temporarily so that they can fight back those algae. The problem that Minnesota has, like Jeff mentioned, is that we have a couple really nasty invasive weeds. And a lot of times when they're in systems, it's hard to get them out, sometimes impossible because of they basically, just like in a prairie or a forest, they get into the seed bank. And so you can go remove all the biomass that's floating at the top, but the next year they're going to come right back. And so, the root cause of too much weeds is actually nutrients. And so, using an herbicide or something like that to remove the weeds is only a temporary solution. It's something that's going to have to be done over and over again. The projects like the one Jeff described is really interesting because that's actually going to let the natural population take over and hopefully be able to keep the Eurasian milfoil or curly leaf or whatever it is in those lakes from being able to come back. So solutions like that could be a way in the future to try and switch it so we get more native, less noxious or nuisance weeds.
When I think about Bald Eagle Lake, I think there are a lot of homes around that lake. I mean, it seems like, I don't know what the lake lot size is, but it's probably less than 100 feet, I would think, of lakeshore for each lot. And when you talk about nutrients in the lake, are we loving a lake like that to death? Are there just too many people around it? Is that where the nutrients are coming from?
Well, in most cases, nutrients are always coming from people, but I don't necessarily think we're loving it to death. I know Bald Eagle Lake, and at least the Lake Association, has done a lot of work. They spent a lot of money making sure that those nutrients from those cottages aren't going into the lakes. And they've also spent, I believe they've done an alum treatment on that lake as well, because the problem is even if you're no longer putting nutrients into a lake, if you did it for 60 years prior to when you shut off the pipe, basically, you have we have this legacy effect where those nutrients are just recycled and can take a long time to get rid of that. And so I believe Bald Eagle Lake has done an alum treatment where they basically bound up all the excess nutrients and buried it in the phosphorus. And this was only in the last couple of years, so I think the results from that are still coming out. But the little I've heard from the consulting firms that have worked on it, sounds like it may have been a success story. So I hope things start to look better there for the caller.
Jeff Forrester, what about this issue, though, of people building around lakes? And we used to not have setback requirements, right? And
right.
That can really damage a lake, right?
It can, especially if it's done unwisely or without consideration for the lake. I think it was probably 10 years ago, Minnesota undertook a sort of a large-scale public policy discussion about what our shoreline, what our minimum standards for developing shoreline should be, and it expired. The plan was presented, and Governor Pawlenty left office without enacting it. So it was a, you know, kind of a pocket veto. And so now we're, you know, we have the same shoreline regulations that we had back in the 80s. But to my mind, if we were to say, okay, we will develop not one more, you know, inch of shoreline, nothing would change. So if shoreline development is a problem now, how do we go back? And this is where a lot of these lake associations do really great work. With the watershed districts, soil and water conservation districts, and Department of Agriculture, upgrading septic systems, making money available to do that work for people that can't afford it, putting in rain gardens, restoring shoreline, you know, not having, you know, the lawn go right down to the water and fertilize the lawn and kind of, you know, control their stormwater runoff. And I'm seeing a lot of action in those areas. And then we're working on as a, you know, we're a advocacy group. So we're working at the state capitol on legislation that would kind of help facilitate the shoreline restoration. And then some lake associations, Leech Lake would be, you know, the Leech Lake Foundation does great work looking at their watershed and trying to map out where nitrogen and phosphorus might be coming from upstream and then getting conservation easements in those areas, working through the legacy
amendment.
Yeah, right. And Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council to kind of get those pieces in place to protect the water.
Hmm, interesting. And I just want to go back to a point the caller made, and I think she was asking, is there some kind of pesticide or acceptable chemical you can use on milfoil, and should we be doing that?
There are some herbicides that can be used, but in most cases, they're prohibitively expensive to apply to a large lake like Bald Eagle. And again, it's only a temporary solution, so you're only treating the symptom. You're not actually treating the problem. So a lot of times when we look to work at lake, working with lake association groups, we first want to deal with what is actually causing the problem. And by shutting that off, then we can hopefully reduce the symptom or if not eliminate it.
And if you have milfoil, though, I always thought that just form that mat of, you know, vegetation. Can you fix that? Can you? How do you fix it, or how do you get rid of it?
You mean once it's already formed the mat?
Right.
Once
the milfoil is in the lake, I guess.
So there's no way to mechanically remove milfoil from the seed bank. And so once it's in the lake, it's going to be there. The only way to do it is to let nature basically take over. So to make conditions right for another plant to outcompete milfoil in its natural environment. And so that's in most cases milfoil or curly leaf, when it's really getting to those nuisance levels, it's because there's excess nutrients in those lakes that are fueling its growth. You wouldn't see that much growth of any aquatic plant without excess nutrients in the system.
Let's go to Milt in Audubon.
Well, good afternoon. I guess it's still good morning.
Yeah, yes.
Hey, I live on a small lake surrounded by large recreational lakes, and mine has an environmental designation. And we do have a lot of requirements, 150-foot setbacks, a lot of water mitigation requirements, and square footage of the property that can be covered by a building. And that's okay. I'm going to nominate my lake, but there's only 8 of us that live on it and only 3 of us full-time, so I don't expect a whole lot of votes.
Oh, that sounds nice.
It's wonderful. And there is no public access. So, but it does have this environmental designation, and with all of these requirements for, and I don't call them restrictions, but things that we can and can't do on that lake. We can only develop 50 feet of our shorefront for beach use. But how does a lake get environmental, or why did it get an environmental designation?
All right, tell us the name of the lake first.
The name is Arrow Lake. It's up. It's a sister lake to Big Cormorant up by Detroit Lakes.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about when you said Audubon. But an environmental designation. How does a lake get that?
Do you know which agency made the designation, or where it came from?
Well, I guess I don't know. I'm assuming it came from the Department of Natural Resources, and it was back. Oh, I don't know how long ago it was, but I mean, we don't have a lot of wildlife. We have, you know, 6 pair of geese and two pair of loons that, that come into the lake every year. But it's just, and that's why I'm asking why or how it got that, why it would have been designated environmental lake when we've got recreational lakes, you know, within 200 feet of it that literally have no restrictions as far as land development.
Well, I know that in some cases when a community does a lake management plan, they'll look at areas of the lake that are undeveloped and areas that are developed and what size the lots are and make designations even for parts of lakes. And so I'm assuming that it probably came out of some sort of local effort. And then those plans go to the Department of Natural Resources, who I think makes the designation, but I'm not entirely clear on that.
Yeah, that was my thought as well, is that it must have come from some community-led effort to protect the shoreline would be my guess, either for that lake specifically or, you know, some lakes in the area. But, yeah, I'm not sure.
So we're a little bit stumped, but that sounds...
I know there are many lakes in Minnesota that have designations. I've been on Deer Lake in Itasca County, which has very strict shoreline restrictions on what kind of built, like you can't put new boathouses can't be built on the lake and things like that. And so... But I think that's all kind of community-led and, you know, maybe the Minnesota DNR, whichever agency, puts the final stamp of approval on it. But I think it definitely comes from the people living in the area and on the lake.
Right. I think it comes from the local communities, goes to the counties, and then moves up from there. I know that when the shoreline rules were originally put in place many, many years ago, it was the Department of Natural Resources that had to patrol the shore. And if they saw development that was... out of line with what the lakeshore was designated as or in violation, then they would write a ticket. And over time, they eventually turned that responsibility back over to the counties.
Hmm.
So I imagine it probably goes from a local community effort to the county with support from the county and then to the DNR for the designation.
That's Jeff Forrester, and we're also joined by Adam Heathcote this hour. Let's take another caller, Taylor in White Bear Lake.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, my favorite lake would be White Bear Lake. I grew up ice fishing on it, going to the beaches in summer. However, White Bear Lake has been steadily shrinking since 2003. It has not been at its normal water level since then. It is lost 5 feet, and some docks as long as 200 feet are now not even in the water. I had a couple of questions. First off, how much of that is due to groundwater versus climate? Two, my second question would be, is this uncommon or are there other lakes that this is happening to? Mm-hmm. And three, if you had time, what are some potential solutions to this?
Okay, good questions about White Bear Lake. Adam, why did White Bear Lake shrink so much?
Well, so this is, even within the research community, this is a fairly contentious issue. I read the judge's ruling on this case, the most recent one, and, you know, a lot of the experts couldn't rule out the impact of pumping. Climate also definitely plays a role. I mean, just year-to-year variation in precipitation. And the reason White Bear Lake is so sensitive to this and the reason that this case was heard was because it's one of the few really, really large lakes that has a majority of its water budget coming from groundwater. It's also why White Bear Lake is so clean. The water is so clear. So that makes it really susceptible to changes in water balance. And so it's very sensitive to that. For those reasons.
And from groundwater, you mean it's coming from the aquifer somewhere?
Yes, exactly.
And so the suspicion would be if the water's going down, the aquifer is somehow shrinking.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, that's a trend all across the United States where all our shallow aquifers are getting shallower and shallower. And if that controls your water level, then and recharge rates are going down, then you're going to get a lower lake level.
And that's even the case in Minnesota, where we have so much water.
Mm-hmm.
But whether or not it was the judge's ruling indicated that she believed it to be the, you know, groundwater pumping that was the cause. But that case is being appealed. So ultimately, I think that the cause of the White Bear Lake decline or lowering water levels will be a matter for the courts. And I'm trying to remember the other two parts of the question. Oh, changing hydrology across the state.
Well, I think he was wondering how much difference was it between groundwater and climate, and it sounds like, at least what we know now, it was mostly due to the groundwater.
Well, I would say it's definitely both. The question is what the proportional blame is for those two pieces.
And climate is linked to groundwater because what's happening now is we're getting more big rain events. So the rain falls and we're getting a couple inches and it runs off the landscape rather than sort of longer periods or lighter rains, more scattered, that tend to soak in more. Mm-hmm. So we're getting more rain in Minnesota, but less of it is
getting
sinking
to the aquifer.
Right, exactly.
Oh, interesting. I forget what his other questions were. I tried to write them down, but I missed them. Sorry about that. Let's keep going, though, because we have a lot of people who have some questions. So let's go to Katie in Bloomington.
Hello.
Hi, Katie.
How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Lake Pokegama outside of Grand Rapids is my favorite lake. My parents would go there with their group of friends from Hibbing in the 1930s. They would rent cabins in the 50s and 60s for our family vacations, and they finally were able to build their own cabin in the 70s, which we've enjoyed ever since. There's also a great co-ed camp on the lake that my sister has directed for over 20 years, and my nieces and nephews have all been counselors there. So there's a lot of sentimental value to that lake, and that was touched on earlier. My question is, the lake has remained very clean through all of those decades. And I have heard that because it approximates the Mississippi River, there is some continual water flow through the lake. So I'd like to know if that's true or if any lake that is close to a moving body of water tends to be cleaner than a different lake.
Wow, that's a good question.
I can take a stab at it first, and Jeff can pick up whatever I miss out on. But one of the master variables that controls how well a lake can clean itself is the water residence time. And so lakes that flush faster, they're more buffered against pollution. And so I don't know the water residence time of Lake Pokegama, but I know it has a dam on it. So I think the water probably moves through there fairly quickly. And so that allows pollution and things like that to move through. Whereas when you're on the opposite end, you know, some lakes don't even have outlets. So once something goes in, it never comes out, basically. Mm-hmm. And so those are the hardest to fix and often get, you know, polluted the worst.
That brings up a question in my mind because we heard that study about how lakes in the southwest corner of the state are unfishable and unswimmable. And I just wondered, once a lake gets into that condition, is there any hope for restoring it and bringing it back? And how would you do that?
It's and you can speak to this, but it's really hard to fix a lake. They're very complex. You know, we can replant prairies or replant forests and do pretty well with restoration in those areas. But lake restoration is very, very difficult and extremely expensive. And then there's a lot of things that are changing, like climate and so forth. So we're trying to manage change now at this point. So it gets very difficult. The best strategy is prevention. Mm-hmm. Protect, you know, what is clean and healthy, and protect the things, the systems within the lake that keep it healthy.
Yeah, I would totally agree with Jeff. The cost to protect a lake is so small in comparison to the cost to fix a lake once it's been pushed into the, you know, that not fishable, not swimmable, not wadeable, whatever all those categories were, that, you know, and you know, a lot of the agencies in the state are aware of that. And that's why we're working really hard to protect those lakes that we have that are still in good condition, because we know that it's a lot cheaper to protect them than to try and fix them once they've gotten messed up.
Well, and I was just thinking as I was listening, talking, you know, as the caller was talking about the memories. You know, memories are one of the, you know, these really good family memories and this heritage in a place over time are really a benefit of lakes. They're really one of the resources that lakes provide to Minnesotans. And it's kind of core to our identity. I also think it happens to be our key to future success. So when you've got a community in a place that values the lake and has these memories of being on a lake over a period of time, they're in the best position to advocate and work towards protection of that lake with the various agencies that are across the state, watershed districts, soil and water conservation districts, Minnesota DNR. And that's a really big piece. You know, one of our messages as a group is claim your jurisdiction, find a role for yourself at the local level to protect water, because that's what it's going to take.
All right, let's hear from another caller, Sandy in Lake Sylvia.
Hi. Well, I'm going to vote for Lake Sylvia, which is straight out Highway 55, close to Annandale, Minnesota.
Okay.
And I'm I have a both a you've touched on a lot of this, but we have a very pristine, very clear lake, and we've fight very hard as an association to keep it that way. But last year we were told that we've got, and I always say it's scary wart, but I think it's called star wart, which is a invasive species that has gotten into our lake. And one of the very, I think, sad things about this is that people who do not live on a lake but bring their boats in and out of lakes for fishing, recreation, don't really realize the sadness of when they come from an invaded lake to another lake that they don't clean their boats. And that's what passes these invasive species from lake to lake. And I know that there is some legislation going on about this, but I just want to emphasize how important that is and what we can do to, you know, make that almost a thing that cannot happen. I mean, from now on, you cannot take a boat from one lake to the other without it being cleaned off so that we aren't spreading this invasive species. Because as you said, once it's in the lake, cost of keeping it under control to the association is horrendous. And, you know, we're the ones that pay the price for that, even though we're not the ones that brought it here.
Okay. Let's get some reaction to that. Jeff, this effort's been going on for a while to try to get people to clean their boats off, but it seems like every year you hear about a couple more lakes have gotten the invasives.
Right. Well, and, you know, there's still people that don't wear their seatbelts.
True enough.
So, you know, we're dealing with that. The violation rate, since we've been working on this, has fallen from about 17% back in 2012 to about 2%. But 2% is enough. And starry stonewort is a difficult thing. But in that area, Lake Sylvia Association and some of the other lake associations that are working to get a regional inspection and, if necessary, decontamination station to pilot it for the first time in Minnesota. The law was passed in 2012, and nobody had really figured out how to do it. But, you know, with 3,800 public accesses in the state, and who knows how many other accesses at resorts or county accesses or even people's yards, you can't put an inspector at every single boat ramp.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do out west, west of the 100th Meridian, is you stop and you get it inspected as soon as you cross into the state. Or, you know, like in Montana, as you get close to the Flathead watershed, you have to stop and get inspected, and you get a tag, and then you launch. And so there, I have a lot of hope in this Wright County mandatory inspection protocol, because the you know, the utility of the lakes really is their use, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you, you know, prevent people from using the lakes, if you restrict access, well, you know, that impacts the economy, that impacts the resorts and all the businesses that are there. So that's not the solution. And the waters are public.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you provide access in such a way that it's affordable? And it doesn't degrade the resource, because starry stonewort's a really bad invasive. It grows from 2 to 12 feet or 20 feet deep, I guess, on Lake Coronis they found it. Crowds out every other plant on Coronis. The cost to the Lake Association and Coronis to keep the access open to treat with chemicals and mechanical harvesters and so forth is about $70,000 a year.
Wow.
It loves spawning beds, so it likes loose gravel and places where fish would spawn, and they can't swim through it. It's too thick. Yeah, it winds up in your prop. You can't really get through it. It's bad.
Hmm.
So, and it's only in 11 lakes now in Minnesota. And I also know Lake Sylvia found it because they had a very active program to check for invasive species there, and they found it early, and they treated it aggressively. And when the ice comes out, we'll find out how well they did. Starry stonewort will grow under the ice, too. It continues to grow all winter long.
Wow.
It's an algae that kind of looks like a plant. So it's tough stuff.
At least we can hope the ice will come off.
Yeah, if the ice ever comes off.
Adam, is there any way, do you think, to fight back these invasives, or are they always going to be a factor at some point?
Yeah, I would just kind of reiterate what was said before. Just to be clear, it is illegal to transport aquatic plants anywhere in the state, and so it's not a matter of passing the law. It's a matter of being able to have enough people to enforce it at all these boat ramps, You have to have someone there almost 24 hours a day to catch every single boat that comes in and out, and so that's the real trick. And you know, a lot of lakes that are being proactive about this are partnering with the DNR or the Soil and Water Conservation Districts to staff someone to go out there, at least during the high season, to just having someone there, even if they aren't able to inspect every boat, is probably enough to make most people think that they better stop and clean off their trailers and empty their live wells before they leave.
Well, or maybe they don't even know they're transporting it, you know? So that's why the inspection piece is so important.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take another caller, Kim in Cambridge.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my favorite lake is Elms Lake. That's the lake I live on. Okay. And what I'm wondering is, what are the actual indicators of the health of a lake? Because we consider them as humans, like, does it have a sandy bottom? You know, can you see through it? Are there a bunch of weeds? And I'm wondering if that's actually considered a ecologically healthy lake, or should there be a ton of weeds on the surface and stuff like that? And
great
then if you have time, I have another question.
Okay, well, let's get that one first.
Well, all lakes are different.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a big piece. Adam, some general?
Yeah, so, I mean, the things that we and others monitor when we're watching lakes to make sure if they are healthy, they stay healthy, or if they're impacted, they don't get worse, as we look at transparency. But as was pointed out, that can have some other confounding variables. We look at nutrient concentrations. We look at the abundance of algae. So how big are the blooms? How long do they last? Do they produce toxins? Things like that. Weeds can be an issue if they're noxious and overabundant. But in most cases, lakes with weeds are actually healthy systems. Weeds are where fish go to spawn in a lot of cases, or at least where the frylings go to hide from predators. So you definitely want weeds in your lake somewhere, so you have that habitat. So,
just on this question of healthy lakes, is a lake, say like Lake Harriet or Lake Nokomis in the heart of Minneapolis, necessarily more or less healthy than a lake, you know, up in where we traditionally consider lake country, somewhere up in north central Minnesota? I guess it depends on the lake.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of how clean the water is, those lakes up in Lake County are going to be far cleaner than any of the urban lakes. But then when you think about the recreational use of a lake in the Twin Cities versus one there, I mean, in terms of just the number of people to visit, it's a lot harder. And so in a lot of cases, we just do we're just trying to hold the line in some of those lakes that have really, really heavy usage and densely populated areas. We're, you know, doing our best to find engineering solutions or to educate the public on ways to help keep the lake cleaner. But when you have a lake that's used by, you know,
over four million people,
it's hard to compare that to a lake that might be visited by a handful of people in any given year.
I know that it's come up over the years that maybe another state could move in and take water out of Lake Superior, or you know, pipe it down to Arizona or somewhere where they're short of water. Is that a real threat? Is that ever going to be possible, Jeff?
Well, it comes up, and I think it would be wise for the legislature to take a stab at that. You know, there's some interstate commerce rules that involve, you know, moving water through a pipe across state lines, some complications with maybe property owners that own property on both sides of the state line. But I would think it would be a good idea if Minnesota did not allow water to leave the state via a pipe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's an agreement by all the governors of all the border states of the Great Lakes to not let that happen, but it's already been challenged multiple times in court. And so that's something to look forward as water shortage is becoming more and more of an issue in the future.
Let's take a call from Kyle in Eveleth.
Hi, guys. I'm a homeowner on a small lake on the Iron Range, and I was just wondering what I can do as a property owner to keep and maintain the health and clarity of the lake.
That's a good question.
Well, which lake first?
I live on Ely Lake.
Okay.
Well, first, you know, the shoreline piece. So, you know, keep a buffer of aquatic plants in the riparian zone close to shore, and then on the shoreline, some deep-rooted plants, trees, and so forth. You know, people often call our office saying that they have erosion problems, and I start to ask them about what plants they have growing. Do they have trees? Do they have bushes? Do they have shrubs? These are the things that stabilize the bank and keep it from eroding away. But then I would also plug in with this. I imagine it would be the North St. Louis Soil and Water Conservation District up there, and I know they're doing a lot of projects to, you know, for the runoff into the lakes, kind of further up the watershed. I don't know if you have a lake association there, but if you do, you could join one, or you could start one if you don't have it. Lake associations are an amazing resource in Minnesota. They spend $6.25 million a year on lake protection and improvement, including about $400,000 a year in fish stocking. And they contribute about 1.2 million volunteer hours working on lakes. So they're kind of the unsung heroes of water quality in Minnesota. And they're really great to plug into because they have a lot of resources and a lot of stuff that you may want to try and do they've done before. You could also see about getting a lake management plan written for Ely Lake, working with some of the other homeowners and the Soil and Water Conservation District people up there. So you have a baseline and you know what's the state your lake is in now, and then you know you can monitor it over time and take action to protect it.
And I know that in years past there's been a problem with septic systems around lakes, and I guess that's a good place to start too. Make sure yours is in good working order and inspected.
Absolutely, and you know the Department of Agriculture can make loans to the county. So if you're a homeowner on a lake or a cabin owner and you have an old or failing septic system, they can be expensive to replace, but often through the county using this Department of Agriculture money, you can get a low or no interest loan to do that kind of work. So there's ways to get it done that can be affordable, and that's a big piece in water quality.
What if you don't live directly on the lake? Is there anything you can do, say, if you just live in the city, like I do, to keep lakes in the area clean or to, you know, at least do your part?
Yeah, I mean, I think the same things apply whether you live on the lake or not. I mean, be active with your local conservation organizations. Even all the urban lakes have people who are really concerned about them and are working at keeping them clean. So I would say find that local unit of government or that local community-led organization that's looking after that lake and join up. And if there's not one, just think about putting one together.
I was going to keep a tally of all the favorite lakes that people called in with and see which lake won at the end. But we had so many different lakes, I don't think we have a clear favorite here. And in fact, we had some other folks who called. One said his favorite lake is Green Lake near Chisago City. Another caller said Ojibwe Lake. Another caller said Deer Lake in Itasca County. I think maybe Eric, who called, put it the best. He said his favorite lake is whatever lake he's on. So I guess that's it, and I guess that's where we'll end our conversation today. So thanks so much for coming in. Adam Heathcote from the St. Croix Watershed Research Station, which is run by the Science Museum of Minnesota, and Jeff Forrester, Executive Director of Minnesota Lakes and River Advocates. Thanks a lot. Great discussion. Really
appreciate
it.
Thanks for having us on.
Great to be here.
This is important.
And I'll just remind you, you can nominate your favorite lake at the website thewatermain.org. You have until Thursday to do that, and then we'll see how that tally goes.